just keep going on.
Just, we're at the...
He needs your assent to be paid.
You have my assent.
And your name is?
Alfred Pollard, General Counsel, FHWA. Maybe we'll do that.
Did I say?
We should probably go around.
We should go around the room.
Well, actually, let's get it on the record.
All right.
Actually, if I can begin, today is September 14th, 2010. This is a meeting where the Federal Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is meeting at FHFA with Mr. Ray Romano to discuss Freddie Mac and its purchase of mortgages and issues of putbacks. If we can all go around the room and state our names and spell any difficult names or longer names.
I'm Steve Pfeiffer, F-I-F-E-R, Office of Credit Risk, Senior Examiner, FHFA.
And I'm Alfred Pollard, General Counsel of FHFA.
Simone Ross, Covington & Burling.
Rob Keller, Covington & Burling.
And I'm Ray Romano, I'm Chief Credit Officer for Freddie Mac.
Jordan Hirschman, Bingham McCutcheon.
Lisa McVitie at Freddie Mac, and it's M-A-C-V-I-T-T-I-E.
It's Tom Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, with Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Bob Hinckley at the FCIC.
Bruce McWilliams, FCIC.
Tom Stanton, FCIC.
John Armstrong, FCIC.
And again, our proposal today would be to, as Tom has outlined, we want to get to the putback issue, but I think Bruce in our discussion said it'd be helpful or useful to maybe start with the intake before we get to the putback. So I've asked Freddie to start with that, a description of how they intake stuff, what they do, how they run it through the machine, and so on and so forth, to give you that description, which would then maybe assist you on the questions you may have later on their undertaking. So if we could start with Freddie, and then after that proceed in any fashion you want. You want to ask them a big question and let them answer, or a series of specific questions, whatever process you want.
I think that's fine. What we are trying to understand at this point is we're starting to see a whole bunch of loans that were either private label securities or sold as whole loans being put back to the sellers of those loans before the financial crisis. And what I said is a trickle. It looks like it's now turning into a river, and we expect maybe it'll turn into something greater than that soon. But we're trying to understand what's giving Freddie and others the right to do this,
sure.
Either contractual or securities.
Okay. And, you know, Alfred, unless you tell me otherwise, I'm going to keep my comments to those of Freddie Mac's core business activity, which is really the purchase and guaranteeing of single-family residential mortgage loans that we obtain through our normal business activities. And I will not entertain the conversation unless, Alfred, you want me to, relative to our investments in private label securities and the potential repurchase issues that might be taking place there. So I'll try to stay with the core business activities, which is, again, with Freddie Mac, that single-family business activity represents about $1.8 trillion of mortgage debt outstanding as it exists today. We acquire those loans, obviously, through a series of approved lenders who agree to sell Freddie Mac loans in accordance with our guide requirements as well as our contractual requirements that we may supplement our guide with. And that's a critical part of this equation. In order for the mortgage market, to operate efficiently at the scale that it operates at, we rely on the contractual relationship between our lenders with the responsibility for representations and warranties that the lenders make to us as to the quality of the loans that they're selling to us. It's not only the accuracy of the information that they're sending to us, but it's also the compliance with our contractual requirements.
May I interrupt you?
Yep.
What are those contractual relationships? Are they essentially the same with respect to the reps and warranties?
Yes. I mean, broadly, I would say
Would it be possible to get a copy of just a blank rep and warranty agreement that I understand is relatively universal here?
Yeah, I think we would. It's two things you need. You need the contract, which is the guide. And then you need and again, we do supplement our contracts with terms of business that we have with our customers. So basically, sometimes we'll change the terms of our guide to do certain business activities with certain lenders.
I apologize. I did not mean to interrupt.
Yeah, but yes, we do.
We've not seen that.
We have the guide, which is a large part of the contract. And then we have a contract with the seller.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but some of this is electronically available.
Oh yeah, yeah. Our guides are available by all regs, and we can get those.
Right. So you access to those. Some of this will get you the link. You won't need the paper. And then if there's any paper samples, they can PDF a paper sample to Bruce or whoever you want to designate. Tom.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead. Can I ask you maybe to help though? There's the automated systems we hear about.
Sure.
And then there's like a purchase, mm-hmm. a big purchase.
Yeah.
Could you distinguish that?
So we do both Fannie and Freddie provide tools to our lenders to understand the overall credit quality of the loans and whether or not it meets our criteria. We call them automated underwriting tools. Lenders have the ability to use those tools to identify whether or not the loan meets our criteria. If they do, they do get some benefits and some relief of rep and warranties that they make to us as to the quality of those loans. Largely, we provide that relief because we're able to replicate a lot of the issues, particularly around borrower capacity and credit worthiness, particularly credit worthiness, because we're able to pull in credit report attributes and analyze them ourselves. And we get a good sense of, you know, what the borrower's willingness to repay the debt is by using our tool. If they don't use our tool, they use Fannie Mae's tool. Sometimes we do allow and accept the use of the alternative scorecards as well in order to be sold to us. But the most important part is we're trying to get scale into the business to be able to serve the broader real estate market, and we rely on a delegated business model. We delegate to the lenders the decision to close loans, and we will fund those loans provided they make representations and warranties to us as to the quality of those loans. And that's all backed by our contracts that we have with those lenders. So that's a critical part of our business model because we couldn't possibly re-underwrite the volume of loans coming from 2,600 lenders, customers that we have contracts outstanding with.
And let me ask you, when you say there's two things, you have these on your website, these are our terms, general terms.
Yeah, we have the general terms.
So they're called seller servicer guides.
Yeah, these are seller servicer guides, the general terms. This is what are minimum requirements to do business with Freddie Mac. But then we may have customized terms of business with customers, and we augment the contracts with these other terms of business.
But electronically automated or individual, these are either incorporated, as lawyers would say, by reference. In other words, the terms that are there are both the guide of how to send it to us through the mail, not through the mail,
That's right.
But also these reps and warranties
That's
are
right.
all made
It's all critical part of it,
right.
And we don't do anything without being in compliance with those contracts. Now, once those loans are sold to us, we take them in. Again, we rely on the rep and warranties that the lenders have provided us. We do a small sample of the loans when they come in, and I mean a small sample. It would be a statistically, a valid sample on an aggregate basis. But we don't try to get down to, every customer. We can't possibly do that. It's just too much volume. What we do rely on is we measure, we monitor, and we look at the performance of the loans over their life with us. And every time, I never want to be using words like every time. What we
did he tell you that?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Attorney client broke.
What we try to do is, if the loans perform poorly early in your life, you're pretty much guaranteed that the loans are going to get reviewed by our quality control department to identify whether or not those loans were properly sold and the appropriate representation and warranty was made to Freddie Mac at the time of the loan was delivered. So imagine, if you would, loans go to foreclosure or to a seriously delinquent rate. Those loans are what are subject to our review. Now, it obviously cuts down the amount of reviews that we're actually looking at. It gets it to a more manageable level. But in an environment where delinquencies are shooting up, obviously our volume is shooting up along with it. So if you think about it, the loan defaults in the first or second year, you pretty much, we're going to be looking at it. If the loan defaulted in the third year but had payment problems in the first and second year, we're looking at it. Same goes for 4 or 5 years out. So we're looking at loans in our quality control department up front as part of a pre-due diligence underwriting, providing lenders with commentary and feedback as to what we're observing in those patterns and practices of compliance with our contractual requirements. And then also we're holding them accountable at the time of a loss event to whether or not those loans actually met our contractual requirements when they sold them to us. And that's a critical part of how we make a delegated business or delegated underwriting model work to achieve the scale of the volume that we do to serve the broader financial market.
Can I ask a couple of questions, yeah. Ma'am? At a time of house price appreciation, does that mean that to a large extent there's no perceived need to challenge loans that might in fact violate reps and warranties because you're in a benevolent environment?
So I would say the strategy, the sampling strategy, is always at work. There are always loans that are defaulting. So we're always looking at loans no matter what. But obviously if housing or the economic conditions, let's define it as broad economic conditions, are declining, whether it's unemployment rates or housing price depreciation occurring, the volume of loans will change, but there are always defaulted loans that are being reviewed, sampled, and reviewed and provide feedback to the customers. In the case of the upfront process, where we're pulling a small sample, doesn't matter what's happening with housing prices. We're pulling a small sample. We're providing lenders with feedback as to whether or not they're complying with our contractual requirements.
Do you do peer groupings so that if you find a counterparty that where the numbers are not as good as your average, you will not only take the loans that manifest problems, but also look at other loans from that counterparty to see what's going on with them?
Yeah, so the upfront due diligence is intended to serve two purposes. One is identify if there are lender aberrations that are going on. So we do sample from as many lenders as we possibly can. We try to then aggregate the results of what we're seeing. And we are identifying what the non-compliant rate is on those loans. We are then providing that feedback back to the lenders. We're also looking for high-risk credit policies, or policies that we think also have some additional risk we want to measure. And we are looking at those loans as well, trying to figure out if our credit policies are working as intended, whether or not they're complying. And we are providing lenders with the feedback as to what our findings are.
Two last questions before ending this interruption. Was it your observation that among your larger seller servicers, Countrywide loans had a significantly worse performance than other loans?
There's no doubt that Countrywide loans had a higher incident of non-compliance rate than some other lenders. Try to put it into a scale, it's readily available information we have about what our findings are and what our conclusions are. But over time, Countrywide's non-compliant rate is higher than our averages.
When did you notice that first?
I don't know the exact date or the time period.
Recently, or it was after 08, say, or before that?
Well, it's you know, it's a lot easier today to tell you that than it was the day they were selling the loans to us. You know, because it's the loans that are identifying themselves and revealing themselves as particularly problematic, not being able to survive through this crisis. Successfully, we're identifying a lot more loans in those, in the countrywide bucket to now the Bank of America bucket. Then again, some lenders, they may not have been the worst, but they were definitely on the higher end of the averages.
Thank you. Sorry, Bob, go ahead.
All right. Could you give us a little bit of a feel of what reps and warranties are made?
It's actually fairly broad. They're actually very specific. The rep and warranties are that the lender has evaluated the loan for compliance with our contractual requirements and have essentially verified and validated the borrower's compliance with the policy requirements relating to the collateral, the capacity of the borrower, and their willingness to repay based upon the standards that are outlined in our contractual requirements.
Could you give them the headers? Because, for example, they have appraisal guidance.
Yeah.
Now, there's some headers that they might understand the breadth of these seller servicer guides.
Sure.
I've been working on the appraisal.
I've been in the primary side of this business for over 20 years. I've been with Freddie Mac for just under seven. And what I know is that there's a series of information in the files that support those sort of the three key principles, right? Credit, capacity, and collateral. So in those files are documentation that support those events. So we are looking at whether or not the borrower's information was complete, accurate, and truthful. We're also looking at the supporting documentation that was used to validate that information, whether or not that was, complete, truthful, and accurate. So think about asset documentation. You would expect, depending upon the loan program, and of course, that through that time period there were some loans that had stated income, stated assets. So you're not going to find income information in some of these files, although they might be stated income, stated asset loans with income information in the file. So we would obviously, when we find those situations, we're going to review it. We're going to identify whether or not the lender looked at it, considered it, and determined whether or not it was reasonable and appropriate. But we are looking at the credit reports to verify all the information within the credit reports. We have the right borrowers. Are the borrower's social security numbers truthful and accurate? We're looking at the income and pay stub information for the same information. Does it support the income necessary in order to meet the debt to income ratios that we require? We'll look at the appraisals for the accuracy and the support for the value conclusion that it arrives at. And what we'll find is we'll find deficiencies in that. In some cases, we'll find deficiencies in the collateral value, where the appraiser didn't use some obvious comparables that were in the marketplace. We went back and did a retroactive appraisal. We found other comparables, that were better suited to the property, and that if used, the value may not have been supported at the level that they sold the loan to us. We would find undisclosed mortgage debts. The borrower failed to either disclose to the lender, or the lender failed to do the proper due diligence to identify all the borrower debts, prior to closing, as they were intended to, and they should have. So we find those issues. We find that they represent the loan as being owner occupied. It turns out that the borrower clearly never occupied the property, and it was used for investment purposes. These are some of the common issues, but we obviously you would not be surprised, but we do find loans that are misrepresented. Borrowers misrepresent the information they supply to the lenders for what I would otherwise term as fraud for home ownership. but we also do find the alternative. We also find fraud for profit, and those loans go back. The lenders are completely on the hook for any fraudulent transactions that we identify as part of our contractual requirements.
What percent of your loans that you identify as violating reps and warranties would you say are fraudulent?
I don't know the number off the top of my head. It's a knowable number. We report activity on a regular basis, fraudulent activity that we identify. So it's knowable.
Mr. Romano, before the financial crisis came on the scene, you must have had a history of putbacks.
Yes.
And can you give us some sense of what the percentage of total loans, where that would take place? I'm trying to create a baseline here.
The way I would have thought about it, and again, 20 plus years in the primary sector, mm-hmm. I've often had to think about repurchases. Repurchases is not new, right? I mean, again, think about it. There's a lot of data fields on an application. Every one of those data fields needs to be supported by some form of a document or some type of credit requirement in our contract. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong within a file. And my experience has been, when we think about repurchase risk, you're probably talking about a risk, again, from my perspective, from Ray Romano's perspective, given his industry experience, you are looking at potential losses of 3 to 5 basis points, you know, on the high end.
Very small.
Very small. And losses, so in any given book year, you know, three to five, I mean, three is on the high end. It probably is 1 to 3 if you're doing a really good job. 3 to 5 if maybe you do, you know, not so good a job. But it's pretty small.
So loans worth 3 to 5 basis points of the total you bought would end up being put back.
That's right. Losses.
What's the difference between losses and loans?
And this is an important point, right? So if I'm a lender, this is how mm-hmm. I'm thinking about it. If I'm a lender, that's what I'm thinking my exposure to loss-producing events is about 3 to 5 basis points.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that, or does it mean that you're talking about a year-end number as it goes, and you may have more in process.
So think about if I originated, pick a year, you know, 2004 book year, and that book year ran its normal life, you know, that has an average life of, you know, let's say 4 or 5 years, I would expect over that book life to lose, having to make the investors whole for losses or having to repurchase a loan and then taking the loss somewhere in the 3 to 5 basis points. But it's not UPB, right? It's not the UPB of what I'm going to be exposed to. It's actually the severity event of the loss-producing activity.
The income producing.
What's that?
Income producing.
It's the actual severity. If I had to take it back and there's a loss, right? So the loan went to foreclosure, REO, and sold. That would be my total loss for that particular book year. That's pretty low.
And that's for which years?
I would say that was, that was my experience prior to, let's say, 2001. So that was historical experience, right? Prior to 2001, in my experience as a primary lender, that's what I thought my exposure repurchases were.
But as I understand, that would also include, I mean, what you said about the REO. Mm-hmm. So that means you get the property, then you go and turn around and sell it.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, I guess the question that Bob may have been asking, well, what percentage or what basis points would you actually put back to the banks? I mean, that would be a bigger number.
So what does it look like today? Right?
And that would be a bigger number than the 3 to 5 basis points.
I think you need to go historical first.
Okay. We got a baseline.
Yeah, need a baseline.
Yeah, so I'm trying to give you. I'll give you the baseline.
I like 2001.
Right. I mean, it just again, this is my experience, right? Not a Freddie Mac. This is, you know, I'm in the lending environment. I'm on the primary side. I'm working for a large bank. I'm actually going out and buying mortgage companies, and I'm looking at this kind of risk. I know this exposure exists, and this is how I'm valuing it. This is how I'm measuring it, and I'm keeping track of it, and that's what I'm seeing. If I'm doing a really good job, I got it around one basis, I mean, really good job, I get it around one basis point. If I'm doing mediocre, you know, around three, and if I'm really screwing up, I'm probably at five. That's my baseline experience. That's what I'm telling you is my expert opinion.
When before let's go to 2001. You have this ongoing process of reviewing loans for putbacks.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a putback, you have a zero loss.
That's right.
All right. I'm assuming the guy you're putting back to is still there.
Well, yeah. Sometimes.
But let's assume that.
Yeah. Let's
assume.
Okay. Let's stick with that.
What percentage?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just for clarity, you're talking about in this hypothetical example
is Freddie.
It's not Freddie. He was talking about.
I was talking about my
I understand that now.
Because now we're mixing.
Yeah, but I want to get to Freddie to have a baseline.
Okay, but that's not the baseline that you just heard about.
I understand that.
Okay.
I understand. Now, once I understood that, that's why I asked this question.
Okay, so let's be clear when you say you, who the you
okay.
is.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just want to be clear.
Typically, in a given year, what percentage of total loans would be put back? And this is before the financial crisis.
It was.
At Freddie Mac, you're saying?
At Freddie Mac.
I don't know the numbers. I mean, I can't quote you the numbers off the top of my head. But again, we do have reports and risk analytics that show us.
Can we ask for copies of documents that give some of these numbers so we can have a context?
Well,
before we get there, and to the extent you guys can help us,
right.
Please help us. We understand now that the number has gone up considerably.
Sure.
Okay, and we're trying to figure out how much it's gone up as a result of, well, not the financial crisis, but the things that caused the financial crisis.
There's a couple of reasons. What's driving the increase? What's driving the increases is twofold. One is our compliance with our contractual requirements. Right? How good were they? That definitely changed as we went through this crisis. Our compliance rate in 2006, 2007, and even a portion of 2008 was much higher than historical experience. We found that the
non-compliance rate.
The non-compliant rate with our contractual requirements, that was higher. And again, I wish I could just rattle these things off, but I just don't retain that kind of information. It's something that's knowable and we go for. But if you're doing you're trying to do a reasonable job, you probably have a non-compliant rate, of less than 5% of your loans are non-compliant. Right?
Mm-hmm.
For which year are you talking?
I'm just saying, in general, if you are doing a really great job for Freddie Mac and you are doing everything you possibly could to deliver compliant loans, you probably still have an error rate of something less than 5%. Right? But that's not obviously what we saw.
What are we seeing?
You could see non-compliant rates in the 25% range. So imagine, it's your rate of your compliance with your contractual requirements, and then how we sample. We sample based on defaults. Defaults are up, and plus your non-compliant rate is also higher. The lenders are definitely exposed to, the obligation of the rep and warranties that they made to us about the quality of those loans they sold. We clearly said, another example. You can't deliver us, condo hotels. You did. Here it is. It's a condo hotel. Why did you deliver it to us? We shouldn't have owned this home.
Would it be helpful here to add, and you tell me if I'm wrong, for the commission's benefit. First, practice before this crisis may frequently have been that the lender identified, not necessarily just the GSE, may have identified, I sold you some loans that I've just discovered are bad, and they would contact them and say, we're going to switch them.
Lenders could tell us that they had some non-compliant loans. We could get tips from people that say, oh, by the way, you should look at these problems, and you can find those. Law enforcement will call us and say, hey, by the way, you should think about these issues. And we'll go in and we'll do some due diligence to try to flush those issues out. So that's how there's a number of different ways to for us to get information about loans that are compliant or not compliant with us.
Okay. So at some point it became apparent to Freddie that this was a whole bigger problem than it ever had been before. A much larger problem.
Yeah, I think we try to measure this exposure to the best we can. It's we try to forecast what things look like, the numbers grew as defaults grew and the rate of noncompliance grew.
And what did Freddie do in response? What do you? We see in the press that between yourselves and Fannie, $9 billion have been put back to four banks. Don't know if that's true or not, but that's what it says. So what? Tell me about the systems you have in place now to put these things back. You must have a lot more people.
We have a lot more people. Yeah, absolutely. We added staff. We added vendors to do the due diligence and the research for us, in order to make sure that every loan where we're taking losses we are doing based on our sampling strategy and our due diligence strategy. We are sampling loans that are resulting in loss-producing events, making sure that those loans were eligible for delivery to Freddie Mac at the time they were delivered, so that if we are taking a loss, it was legitimately a loss that we contracted to buy.
And at what point in time did this relatively low level of buybacks become something more serious? 2007, 2008?
I would say you started seeing delinquencies rise as early as 2006. Unemployment rate, housing prices declined, starting to impact borrowers. And once those rates start to climb, you see the incident rates of putbacks increase.
Did Freddie Mac tighten its credit standards when you saw that in 2006?
We began tightening credit policies in the 2007 time period, yes.
Early or late?
What's that?
Early or late 2007?
I'd say starting August of 2007, we took a posture of no further expansions of credit policy and a bias toward tightening.
You described a system of reps and warranties that was broad and which could be violated for a whole number of reasons. Do you see any patterns in
you saw a fraud claim. Were you seeing an increase in misstated income, or was it
FICO scores?
Yes.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at is, what was the misrepresentation, the material misrepresentation? We're talking about fraud here now. I want to come back to the reps and warranties generally.
Relative to fraud, I'd say top category is borrower misrepresentation of debts. That's number one reason. They misrepresented mortgage debts outstanding and other debt outstanding. We do see evidence of misrepresentation of income, occupancy, and loan purpose.
Is that the rank order?
I think that's probably about right.
You say loan purpose.
Investment versus ownership?
It was really investment versus second home, more so than anything else.
Could I ask, if you're seeing this, would the originator also be seeing this? And if it's fraud, they're supposed to be reporting it to FinCEN?
If we're finding and identifying these fraudulent issues, again, these are remedy. We look for remedies on these when we identify these issues, largely they result in repurchases.
When you identify a loan as suspect, what happens? Walk us through what you do once mm-hmm. that happens.
So, relative to fraud or just in general?
In general, and then come down to fraud.
And you want to know today, you want to know yesterday?
Well,
Let's do yesterday, Mr. Day, yesterday.
I'm not sure how different it is from yesterday, but in large, in broad brush, right? In broad brush, it is, the process is, again, depending on the sample, we have a few different samples, right? We have the biggest one that gets a lot of the attention is the non-performing loan sample, we call it. Those are loans that defaulted, and we're sampling those. There is the upfront performing loan sample, which is a very fairly small, pretty close to the time we purchased it. We do some sampling for charter requirements. We do some sample for charter.
Do they have charter mortgage insurance that they're supposed to have?
Are they within the right loan size?
Okay. Your charter.
Our charter. We do some sampling for predatory lending law requirements, for points and fees tests in particular. And we also do some very high-level screening of loan eligibility, whether it's based on FICO and LTV and debt-to-income ratios. We'll try to screen those. So in general, those are the types of categories.
You get a loan that is it's non-performing. Yep. Are you going to look at that in any case, or is that just number of loans that's like a sample? And what do you do with the rest of it?
Right. So it depends on when it defaults, right? So again, if it defaults in the first 2 years, generally we're going to pull every one of those, not every one, but most every one. If it defaults 3 years after origination, it really depends how the loan performed in the early part of its cycle. If it reached a 60-day or 90-day delinquency in the early part of its life, I don't care how old it is, it probably is going to get sampled, even if the default is 3-4 years after. Because it indicates there's a problem, there could be a problem in the underwriting analysis of that loan. So it gives us the ability to target the resources on the loans that have the highest probability of not meeting our contractual requirements.
Got it.
So we're pulling samples, again, based on age. We just call the lender up, say, here's this month's population of loans we need to sample. They have a period of, 30 to 45 days to send them into us. We then open the physical files, look at what they have to say. We compare it to our contractual requirements, lay them side by side, identify where we have deficiencies. We notify the lender of our deficiencies. That gives them the right to cure the deficiencies. Maybe they didn't send us the entire file. It's possible. It happens a lot. We don't get the entire file. And they come up with the right information, the income information on the loan. If that happens, close the case, move on. If it doesn't, then we put it out for remedy. Basically says, this loan is subject to repurchase.
So you could get data deficiencies like zip codes, that somebody mm-hmm. entered 25 zip codes wrong in a neighborhood, right. that person should have the right to cure if it's an otherwise valid
right.
loan, but they still have to cure it.
Right.
These are non-material.
Non-material.
Yeah, there are some non-material. Okay, if you're a lender, you'd say, Freddie Mac, you're very capricious in how you execute loans because you have a self-interest in just.
They've already defaulted, right? I mean, sorry.
Yeah, lenders have a different view as to what we're doing. We're looking at the files. We're being very objective. We have a strike zone, balls and strikes. We call balls and strikes. If the loan's eligible, it's eligible. It doesn't matter if it defaulted, but it's eligible. We keep it. We don't put it back. But if the loan clearly was outside of our contractual requirements, the loans are going back, and it's intended to be, a material issue, not non-material issues. It wasn't, we asked for a 720 FICO and it came in at 719.
I'm having trouble determining whether or not as you said, if a loan's outside the strike zone, it's a ball. If it's in it, it's a strike. And mm-hmm. but that indicates that you're looking at every bloody one of them.
Not every.
And you can't be doing that.
No, we're not. We're not looking at every loan that defaults. We're looking at loans that default and fall within our sampling strategy. And our sampling strategy is based on risk, it's based on origination year, payment patterns, and behaviors.
What percentage, just you may or may not know this, of defaulted loans do you actually review? I understand it's statistically significant, but...
Yeah, we have triangle reports that would tell me that information.
I'd like to see some of those, if I may.
Okay.
But essentially what you're saying, if it's a default that occurs in the first 2 years, it's close to 100%.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's going to be pretty close.
And after that, for a couple of years, it depends on what the history was of the loan during the first 2 years.
That's right.
Or up to the period of default.
That's right.
If you have a counterparty who's sending you loans that are going bad, say, in years 2 and 3, at an unusual rate, or even earlier, do you then go back and, according to your sampling formula, sample more of their defaulted loans?
We might. It would depend.
Depends on what.
I don't think it's. I don't think you. If your question is, we'll pick a lender. Lehman Brothers, is it possible that we'll do more due diligence if we're finding really a very high non-compliant rate? One would think we would.
Well, I'm trying to get at the question of, you sample a certain number of defaulted loans, and among those loans you put back the ones that look like they have material misrepresentation.
Right.
But what about the defaulted loans you haven't sampled? Do you put any of those back?
No. No, the answer to that is no. We sample, the only ones we
that
put back
sense.
Are the ones we sample. Right. We don't just unilaterally put back loans without having cracked the files, looked at them, and had a
well,
good
I'm trying
justification for
to
it.
Get at is to understand, say you have a lender that goes between this 5% and the 25% rate, depending on the year, and say they're above average. Would that be an invitation to say, we're going to look at all the loans that have defaulted in a period of time because we need to put back many more loans because it looks like this is not a good lender?
I'd say it's within our option. I don't think that's been our practice.
Thank you.
Well, could I ask, though, Tom's giving you some triggers. I think he's looking at triggers, a fair way to characterize.
Well, I'm trying to get at the issue of they sample some loans, they put some back, but all of a sudden they realize if I turn over another rock,
right.
I'm going to find
right.
a lot more.
So
why not put those back?
Well, let me question it. One is, you mentioned earlier, is that you're routinely talking to these seller servicers.
Oh, yeah.
So patterns that emerge, you may be talking about that long before you ever get the putbacks. Like
that's right.
What's going on at your place and things like that.
No, that's absolutely right, Albert. And the other side of it is, like, when you get to things like when we identified suspicious activity, fraud, anytime we identify fraud, we immediately take the most relevant information about the associated parties in that transaction, the appraiser, the title company, the loan officer, the realtor. We put all that into a database, and then we look and we do data mining on that for identify patterns and practices. When we identify patterns of issues, we immediately go after large grouping of issues as part of our fraud activity. Mm-hmm. We absolutely do that. But again, in the general practice on the non-performing loans, it's part of our sampling. It's just part of our sampling strategy. We'll go across each lender based on a strategy for that particular lender. But I don't, I'm not going back to loans that defaulted in 2005 that I never sampled, that resulted in a loss in 2005. I have not gone back and looked at those loans and tried to put those back.
What about loans from, you sample in 2007, you find an unusually high rate, do you then look at all the other loans from 2007 that lender generated?
No, we're not doing that.
Okay.
To what extent, if any, do you have to resort to the courts in connection with your reps and warranties? Maybe that's a question for you lawyers.
I can tell you, some people have challenged us on our contracts. Mostly, they're They're challenging us when we're pulling servicing, because part of our contractual requirements are that if you don't adhere to our contract, we can pull the servicing and take all the servicing income that you may have hanging on.
Take over the servicing?
Oh, yeah. We take it over and we move it over.
Okay.
We had some lenders challenge us through both the bankruptcy process as well as through our rights to do that.
You can also pull them being a seller of service.
And we can pull their ability to be a seller of service.
Nuclear option, right. I guess so you call.
We do have people challenge on that issue. We have been very successful that our contracts are very tight, and we have the rights to do that. We have not had a active lender, as far as I know, ever challenge our contractual right to put loans back to them. At this time.
It's not a wise business strategy.
It's a right they have,
yeah.
But we haven't seen it actually happen.
Can we help just real quick? I think we ought to be clear. I think it's some of your questions. What I think was being said was a default does not necessarily violate the rep's warrant.
Yes,
in other words, someone loses their job,
yeah.
the lender never, so you could have more defaults, obviously, than you may have putbacks.
Right.
It's only for violating some term. They do assume certain risks,
yeah.
Which is not in their reps and warranties, which is we're going to take the credit risk that the person, in effect,
right.
Loses their job. So I just want to be clear on that, because I think
you're
not looking at every default, which is a fair question, I think Tom's asking.
Yeah.
But there's also a factor that not every default is a breach. It's
that's
just
right.
Sometimes people, I mean, the biggest one, I guess, you tell me,
no,
they lose their job. Well, they don't ask people to rep and warrant. This person will never lose their job. That's
sure.
You know.
But just a question of clarification. I went to Tom's point question. Ray, I thought you had said that among the sampling criteria, if a loan has defaulted within the first couple of years, that's already caught by the sampling.
It's pretty much
to begin with. Right. So as far as the category that I think Tom was talking about, like book years of 2007 or 2008, if you're seeing defaults on loans from those book years, you're looking at those loans.
Well, again,
they're caught by the sample, right?
So today is 2010, 2007, the sample strategy is a little bit lower, but it depends on the payment history. If the borrower had payment patterns, trouble making payments early in the life of that book, and again, loans fly, you know, loans change status. Some borrowers can make their payments consecutively, you know, for 4 years. Some people rattle around in delinquency status, and those loans get caught in our process.
And
have a high probability of being sampled.
The process is basically tied to defaults. When you start to lose money, then it's time to start looking at these things.
But it's so again, it's a how do you? It's a system of contracts,
mm-hmm.
delegation, and accountability. And we're holding our lenders accountable for the quality of the loans they're selling to us based upon their compliance with our contractual requirements.
It's a
feedback loop.
But I have to add here, I think there is an exception, which is suspicion of fraud.
Yeah. Well,
there's a suspicion of fraud, because what you're not hearing here today, we had a briefing on mortgage fraud. We were the first regulator to come out with a mortgage fraud regulation just on mortgage fraud. They get a suspicion of fraud, they run it through a process, and even before it's confirmed that it's mortgage fraud, they file through us.
That's
because
right.
They don't have Bank Secrecy
right.
Act protection. And we file. We're the filer of the SAR with FinCEN.
That's right.
So okay. That's the one.
Okay.
We'll do that on monthly.
So your comment about defaults.
So basically the system, a lot of it's tied to defaults, but there are other various factors and screens that you use
mm-hmm.
that basically are designed to tip you off early to
that's
potential
right.
defaults.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that all makes sense to me. Mike, now can we start getting towards what's happened historically in terms of, you said that delinquencies have gone up, non-compliance has gone up. How successful has Freddie been in putting back loans to originators? That's sort of a wrong way to put it, because you're not successful. but to what extent have you had to put back loans to originators as a result of the increase in non-compliance?
I'd say we have put back requested repurchase from lenders in a very sizable way, much larger than by historical standards. We have not always been successful. There are some lenders that have gone belly up in this process. I can't put a loan back to Lehman Brothers as of the moment, because they're currently in bankruptcy. But the moment I have the opportunity to collect on the claims, I plan on it.
Do you ever have that situation where you fear that your actions will trigger some negative impact on that company for bankruptcy? Or?
So if your question is...
Do you pull your punches?
Will I take action to protect Freddie Mac, and or will I not take action to protect Freddie Mac because I think it would have detrimental impact on the seller? That's not my concern. I have a concern about the financial viability of that counterparty to make whole Freddie Mac. But if I find that they're financially weak and cannot meet the obligations, I'm going to take every action I can to try to protect us. And that is, there is a form of collateral in this whole structure, and it's called mortgage servicing rights. The MSRs on these loans are a form of collateral for us. And the question becomes, if I believe that the counterparty is not going to be able to make us whole for our obligations, I will move the servicing. I will move it to...
We are crossing also into conservatorship here, where the enunciated position of this agency is preserve by statute and conserve by statute the assets of the company.
And
so we have a policy of actively pursuing, communicated to the enterprise to actively pursue. And I think one of the questions that's being asked is, well, how do you find all these docs? They have to go through a file, because if you don't, the other party would say, what's your proof that I violated your rep and warranty? Just because it defaulted is not enough proof. But I would tell you that our position has been that they are to go and seek their recovery, and we will even use conservatorship powers, which are more potent than the enterprises, in order to pursue if necessary. Now, we haven't had to, and that's where we start to cross into another topic that we're not going to go into today. But before you get to that topic, I would tell you it is our position that they should vigorously pursue.
I get some reluctance that nobody here wants to tell me a number, or a number for 2007, 2008, 2000 putbacks.
I can go back to my office. If you want to know 2007, 2008, I can tell you exactly the numbers. I have them. They're available.
Yeah. Okay.
So
right.
But you know, just the challenge I'm going to have is like the number you see. Right, I'm trying to be helpful for you. Right,
no.
The number you see in the paper, you see $11 billion putbacks. Well, that's UPB, right?
Right.
So a borrower defaults on a $100,000 mortgage. That's what you see. You see a $100,000 loan being put back.
Right.
The loss to the company is the actual severity of that loan. So if you see an average of 35% severity, you're really talking about a $35,000 loss to that institution. So, but I don't know what happens to the loan after it leaves our shop, right?
Right.
If I'm doing the job, everything is working like clockwork, which it rarely does, but if it works exactly like clockwork, it leaves the Freddie Mac in the loan form and goes back to the lender in loan form, and I get paid back UPB.
Yep.
I get paid back at par,
yep.
UPB. I don't know what happens to the loan after that. I don't have any more information.
At this point, I don't really care.
Right.
I'm not trying to figure out how much the originator loses on the loan.
Okay.
I'm trying to get some understanding of the magnitude of the loans that were sold that were non-compliant. We see the same thing in, essentially, we're seeing it in the PLS area, too, where investors weren't necessarily told everything that was material for them to be told in connection with the sale. And the other day, we came across a suit for investors that invested $351 billion in various, I'm sure you've seen this. And so we're trying to get some idea of how prevalent the originators were playing loans in the securities markets. It looks like they were also playing games in the securities market. They were also playing games here. And we're trying to get some idea of the magnitude of that.
Yeah.
And on a UPB basis.
I think he's just trying to say the face value that you see in the paper, when you, a little bit mixing of losses versus what I think you're asking very fairly is, if you have 100 loans, or you have a portfolio of $100 million, how much was put back for some material reason?
Is the number that's in newspapers, the $11 billion, $9 billion, whatever, is that UPB or is that losses? That's UPB, isn't it?
I think the $11 billion that you're referring to is a research report that S&P put out that forecasts what the expected repurchase rates are still outstanding between Fannie and Freddie, based on loss content, not UPB.
Oh, that's loss.
That's loss.
So we're talking a much bigger number.
Well, again, just to be clear, what Ray is telling you is what his recollection is of a particular S&P article that he thinks you may be referring to, which maybe you are and maybe you aren't. Okay, so the article says whatever it says.
Okay, so it, do you have any idea off the top of your head what, in terms of UPB, Freddie has put back over the last 3 years?
No.
None?
No, I don't.
Order of magnitude?
I wouldn't want to speculate and guess on it.
But
I can give you the number.
Yeah, okay.
Why don't you give us a number?
I think afterwards there's been a number of things that you're interested in, and maybe you'll, pull something together about what you want to get.
That's great.
And we'll
put that at the top of your list for tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad somebody's prioritizing.
Well, that's what we're here for. Well,
I know.
Out of curiosity, how many loans would Freddie Mac buy in a year in this area? Single family, residential, mortgage loans.
Yeah, so, we will purchase somewhere close to, $300 billion of loans. With that, probably an average loan amount of, current production around $250,000. That gives you the order of magnitude.
Where's my disappointment? Yeah. The decimal point goes, is it a million or is it a little more than a million? Or
it's a little over a million.
Little more over a million loans.
Yeah.
And okay. And you have no idea how many loans get put back, leaving aside UPB
on a percentage
basis.
Writing, so
I'll just give you the chart. Right?
Fair enough.
Give you the chart that shows.
Tom's good at asking the questions and we're good at answering. So.
Good.
All right.
Thanks.
That's great.
It's very, very simple chart.
Do you see, if I'm crossing into territory you want to go, let me know, Alfred. Do you see this percentage going up in the next couple of years, or is it now basically have we gone over the hump and it's starting to come back down?
I would say that we have, it's a function of, again, compliance with our underwriting standards, right? So let's if we stipulate that 2009, 2010 had a really high compliance rate, meaning loans are really solid, very good quality.
Which is a fair stipulation.
I think it's a fair stipulation.
Okay.
So then it's really about 2006, 7, and 8, those books. 2006 is now almost 5 years old. It's now 4 years old, right? But clearly 4 years old. It's starting, the sampling strategy is starting to come down. 2007, it's sort of in the middle. 2008 still has a little way to go. So I think overall, my expectation, if I'm forecasting, my expectation is repurchase rates are beginning to decline.
Okay. We didn't touch on this before, but we've interviewed some people who said there was they thought there was a geographical correlation to this, that it happened more in some states than in others. Does Freddie track that, and is that?
Sure. Yeah. Defaults are, pretty horrific in Florida.
No.
We have, when we find non-compliant rate, Florida is not a great state. Neither is Nevada, Arizona, California. All the hardest hit states that...
Is Michigan one of those?
Michigan's always been a problem.
They're always in the news.
Yeah. Michigan hasn't been great for a long time, from a economic point of view. But, we do see, the correlation there.
I think we talked about fraud, and the elements of fraud that you saw. How about non-fraud, non-compliance? Have you sort of graded that out as to anything being more important than others, or?
I mean, it's a lot about collateral issues, valuation issues, being a significant issue, as well as lenders just failing to calculate income and debt ratios correctly. Just bad due diligence on their part.
Okay. Anybody else?
How many folks have devoted to this process? How many folks do you have devoted to your review here?
In the quality control department alone, there's probably in excess of 150 actual people working on site. But we also use vendors. We contract out to outside vendors to perform the due diligence for us to supplement our resources.
Clayton Holdings, someone like that.
We use Avitac. We're not using Clayton. Avitac is probably one of the largest ones. Am I missing any, Steve?
That's the big one.
I just had you look at stuff coming back. I just had one visit me an hour ago.
checking up on your mortgage.
No, it's the guy I told you.
Here's another.
No, it's the guy I told you. He's out here.
Another sizable repurchase event. Mortgage insurers, we see this a lot in this environment, are rescinding mortgage insurance coverage. That should not be underestimated. That is a fairly sizable. If you don't have mortgage insurance, you must be repurchased.
And is that happening because the mortgage insurer has found fraud or something, or is it for a variety of factors?
I'm certain that the mortgage insurers have done a really good job doing their due diligence, and they've done their reviews just like we would have done. But I would say we find more cases where we don't see any issues with the loans than the mortgage insurers otherwise report. So in other words, we think that they are perhaps finding minor issues for rescissions.
Ray, you could put it in the same vernacular. They have reps and warranties.
Yes.
In fact, the MI coverage, I think Ray's saying it's not necessarily fraud.
Does that automatically result in a putback, no default or anything?
If the loan doesn't have mortgage insurance, it's a repurchase.
It's a charter of that.
It goes right back out.
Okay.
Cure it, and you're good to go.
I was going to say that.
What's that? Oh, it is. It's been one of the, in the most recent period, particularly in 2009, it seems to be abating at this point, as recently as probably the second half of 2010. We starting to see the mortgage rescissions abate. But in 2009, 2010 is probably one of the top reasons.
I just had a question. Something you said about the, go back a step, about the non-compliance in the 25% range. So that's default, then an examination, a sampling of the defaults. And before you were at 5% were non-compliant, but now you're 25%. Is that correct?
That's
5%. Okay. That's 25% of what you test. It's not 25% of it's $300 billion a year.
So it's probably it's 25% of what we test.
Correct. Got it.
As opposed to 5% pre-crisis.
Right.
So five times more.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then add to that default rate.
Those people are already defaulted, right?
No. Well, again, non-compliant rate and default rate, they're both part of the equation. So the default rate was running around 50, 60 basis points, and today it's 400.
So eight times defaults and five times non-compliant.
Sure.
But you only examined the defaulted ones, right? Is that your sample?
That's correct.
Okay.
So if you did your job perfectly and you get a 100% compliance rate, the default rate could be 100%. And you have no repurchases.
Right. So.
But the fact of the matter is that you went from what I would have otherwise said as probably an acceptable error rate of something less than 5%, you went to 25%, and the default rates went up dramatically. That leads to very large volumes of repurchasable events.
You said 60 basis points to 400? Is that what I mentioned?
Yeah, that was probably about the average.
Okay.
90-plus day delinquencies, we're running around 60 basis points. You know, less than 1% cumulative defaulted loans in the, over the life of the loans. That was a typical event. Now we're running again. And so I was giving you delinquency statistics, but if you want to change it, you want to get the orientation more on a life of loan book. Agencies, Fannie Freddie, typically, cumulative lifetime default rates were running probably less than 1%, just around 1%. Today, they could be running close to 8 to 10.
When did you here begin to see what you perceived as a deterioration in the underwriting standards?
2007.
No clue before that?
I mean, I would say, so let's be clear, we said a decline in underwriting standards, I think we made it very publicly that the underwriting standards were declining from 2005, 6, 7, they were declining. I think our public disclosures clearly show that. But the non-compliance rate was probably the, is in the 2007 time period.
Is
you had the non-traditional mortgage announcement in the fall of 2006, but they have pipelines, so to speak.
That's right.
Deliveries. So
we have contracts, right? These contracts.
Yeah, but well, I'm just trying to put it in short vernacular.
Yeah.
So when they discover and do their sampling, it might have been for an 2006 loan, mm-hmm. correct, in 2007, mm-hmm. Where they were. So I think, you know, I think that they got this pipeline they filled with stuff.
What's the explanation? What's your explanation for declining underwriting standards? You must have talked it over with somebody at some place along the line.
I committed I'd give you that answer after the event.
Well, good. Let me go.
We do have some other guests, but go ahead and see if you have any.
You know, please. You want me to, you know, why did underwriting standards decline?
Yeah.
I wish I could answer that question. I mean, why did they decline? I think maybe the gentleman from the Citigroup said it best. Everyone was dancing, so the music was playing, and they were dancing.
Yeah. One topic.
I don't know.
It was just a matter of chasing market share and keeping.
You know, market shares was probably a part of the equation, but it is a. It wasn't that, you know, Freddie Mac wasn't thinking about the risk issues. We talked about the risk issues. We considered the risk issues, and business judgments were made. And I would tell you that if you look at our record, I can say even more so than your next guest, we have the best performing portfolio at the worst possible time. I don't feel great about it, but. You know, look at our delinquencies, look at our default rates, they're lowest in the industry. And we're sitting at 90-plus day delinquents of, call it 380 basis points, and the private label market is 35%. Fannie's a little bit higher, probably running just a little, you know, tad over 400 basis points, or just under 500 basis points. But when housing prices decline like this, I don't care if you have the safest loans out there, they're sitting right next door to all these other loans. So, you know, you drive through your neighborhood and you think about what's happened to your housing prices and, you know, if your neighbors are defaulting on their loans, they're bringing your value of your house down. And that's triggering defaults.
If the
equity is a big driver of defaults.
If the commission would bear up, because we're trying to get two in today, and certainly so not shy about sending me questions to follow up, but I think if we could go ahead and bring next week, perhaps
thank you very much.
Lessons learned here that you
helpful. Very helpful.
Thank you very much. Very helpful. Very helpful.